During a career in football that spanned more than 50 years, Bill Curry started in three of the first five Super Bowls, including the very first one back in 1967. He also played for three legendary head coaches, beginning with Georgia Tech's Bobby Dodd. Curry learned plenty from the renowned Yellow Jackets leader, much of which helped shape his own coaching tenure. But what was the greatest lesson he took away from him?
Well, that's easy. Easy to answer, difficult to execute. The great message that Coach Dodd delivered was that each human being has incredible potential, and that education is absolutely essential to unlocking that potential. And if you're going to be a part of this program, yes, we're going to play football, and we're going to win more than we should, and it's going to be fun. We're not going to kill you on the practice field, and he kept his word on that. But you will go to class, and you will do what's necessary at one of the most difficult educational institutions in the world to graduate. If you do not see fit to cooperate with that mission, you will not be here. But I want every single one of you to graduate, and I believe you will, and I'm counting on you, and about 90% of us did. That was his message, and it was delivered in the most powerful ways regularly. It gave me a chance to compete in an institution that where I really didn't belong academically. I wasn't dumb, but I had not worked hard in high school. But I learned how to think, and I learned how to work, because that's what you have to do at Georgia Tech. People think I'm lying when I say this, but it's a fact. We had Saturday morning classes, so you might have accounting and statistics at 8 o'clock and 9 o'clock, and you play Alabama at 2 o'clock, same day. You better be in those classes. So it was a serious academic lesson, and one that we all treasured later in life. We didn't treasure it so much when we were going through it.
Now, the transition from college to the NFL is always a difficult one, but your leap to the professional ranks landed with the Green Bay Packers and the unmistakable presence of Vince Lombardi. Describe your initial impression of him and how your relationship evolved.
Stark terror. Everybody was intimidated, but I was especially intimidated, and I did not like him because I thought the epitome of what a great coach should be was the Southern gentleman. And not only was he not Southern, but he didn't care if you liked him. He didn't care if you were happy. He cared only about your productivity. As it turns out, he had great wisdom in what he did, but I couldn't understand it until years later when I had grown up some. And I actually had to go to his deathbed and apologize to him for not understanding him, for making public remarks to that effect.
That Packers team that you joined had already reached legendary status with so many future Hall of Famers on the roster. Were there any particular players who you gravitated to or that took you under their wing in your rookie season?
Yes, there were certain players that stood out, that went out of their way to not just accommodate, but to educate me in the things that I needed to learn. My biggest challenge reporting to the Packers was that I had never been in a huddle with an African-American person. I was from Atlanta, Georgia. I had a Southern accent, and Vince Lombardi was the least racist of all of the organization leaders in the NFL. In fact, he would not tolerate any kind of prejudice. Now, this is 1965, and there were still teams that bragged about having no African-American players or quotas of one or two. He had 10 on a 40-man roster, and we would have had 40 because he didn't care about pigmentation. He cared about effectiveness. He cared about your character. So I was intimidated by that fact as well. I knew it put me at a disadvantage, and I thought those guys would probably resent me and injure me and send me home. But instead, the defensive captain, Willie Davis, essentially adopted me and loved me through it, and really changed my life, transformed my perception of every human being because of the way he treated me. And I found that that's what great teams have. And then from the other perspective, Mark Starrs, just made me his little brother, and that has lasted to this very day. So, great human beings, and those two led the way for me.
Yeah, I want to talk about Bart Starr. As a center, you got the chance to snap the ball to him on a regular basis, and eventually also Johnny Unitas. Unitas's credentials are well-documented and well-deserved, still among the greatest quarterbacks. But Starr, why do you think Starr, who won the MVP of the first two Super Bowls, doesn't exactly get the notoriety he deserves?
Because people aren't paying attention. Nobody else has won five world titles in 7 years, and they never will. I mean, nobody will ever match that, but Bart Starr did. And he called the play. I mean, he didn't have somebody in his ear telling him what to execute. So, I mean, for him not to be in the conversation about the greatest quarterbacks of all time means that the scholars are simply not good scholars.
In 1966, the Packers went 12-2 and beat the Dallas Cowboys to win the NFL title again and earn a spot in the first Super Bowl. And you were the starting center for that initial encounter between the NFL and the AFL. What was the pressure like for the team and Coach Lombardi to simply win the game, considering how superior people viewed the NFL over the AFL?
The pressure was staggering on him. I'm not sure we were aware that that other owners were calling him. I mean, owners that were buddies of his, because there is no owner in Green Bay, and he was essentially the whole organization when it came to league meetings and such. We could tell he was even more uptight than usual, but it was only afterward that we learned that the weight of the world was on his shoulders. And he was especially difficult to live with during those 2 weeks of preparation, I'll put it that way. But the team played really well. I was injured in the game and had to leave the game, but Ken Bowman went in and did a great job, and we won going away against a very good football team.
At this moment, fans are massed down to our left. The Coliseum floor is green. To our right, the yellow end zone with Chiefs spelled out in red letters and the American Football League emblem. To our left, in green letters, spelled out Packers with the NFL familiar shield. And in a few moments, I'm sure that we will have our national anthem.
This is the entire National Football League against the entire American Football League today, a game that people have been looking forward to for 7 years. And don't think that those 80 fellows, 40 on each team, don't feel this right now in their locker rooms. They're all alone there, and the tension is just tremendous.
I was watching the rebroadcast of Super Bowl I on NFL Network recently, and it was quite remarkable to see all the differences from then to now. The halftime show, the introduction of the starting lineups with the players running out and standing in front of the camera, seeing all the empty seats at the Los Angeles Coliseum. To you, with respect to that time period, did it have the feel of a big game?
Well, it had been hyped so much that we knew it was supposed to be a big game, and it seemed like there were six networks there. NBC, CBS, I know there was just the two that combined to broadcast the thing, but there were radios, so it already had the feel of big media attention, but the rest of it felt like a scrimmage. I mean, really, we would go to L.A. to play against the Rams, and the stadium might not be full. There'd probably be 80,000 or so, but there were... There were a lot of empty seats, and that was a strange feeling.
As you said, the Packers would pull away in the second half and win. Did your perception and the perception of the Packers themselves of the AFL change at all, for better or worse, once the game was over?
Oh, yeah. I think we were surprised at how good they were, and we knew that they were good enough to beat anybody. And, of course, they went back to Super Bowl IV and proved that. By just dominating the Vikings. That was a really good football team. And as for other people saying they weren't very good, I had Buck Buchanan on my nose. So, I mean, it was a miserable day for me. And I wish I hadn't gotten hurt, because maybe I could have done a better job against him.
You would move on to the Colts, Baltimore Colts, for the 1967 season. And in 68, they went 13-1 during the regular season and then defeated the Cleveland Browns, the only team you lost to during the year up to that point, by a score of 34-0. That set up a meeting with the AFL's New York Jets in Super Bowl III, and despite being 18-point underdogs, Joe Namath made his guarantee in the week leading up. From a Colts perspective, Bill, how did your team's focus on the game, the preparation specifically, change once you heard Namath make that kind of a bold statement?
Nobody paid attention to that. Well, other people had predicted they were going to beat us before that, and nobody could. I mean, that team, history has forgotten, and this is what happens in America. If you don't win the big game, they don't remember you anyhow. But in 1967, the Baltimore Colts were 11-1-2 and did not make the playoffs because there was no such thing as a wild card rule. The next year, in 68, we were 15-1 going into that game with the Jets. So we lost two games in 2 years. And the only thing that anybody remembers is that we're losers because we happened to lose that big game. But we didn't prepare any differently to them than we did everybody else. We prepared well. We beat them the next four times we played them, but nobody cares about that. That's how life works. We turned them all over too much. They had a good football team, and when you do that, you get beat.
Was there anything that struck you most about the Jets that you didn't anticipate? Was there an aspect of that team that took you or the team by surprise?
No. Well, what took us by surprise was our performance and the fact that we just turned the ball over. And we missed field goals, stuff that we had not done all year and that you have to do if you're going to beat a good football team. And I thought Namath in particular, but also Matt Snell and Winston Hill, the fullback and the left tackle, played especially well to keep the football away from us and just dominated time of possession. And when we did get it back, they made big plays to force turnovers, and that's how you beat somebody that's supposed to be a favorite.
I can imagine after that 16-7 defeat, the motivation for redemption was tremendous. It would take two seasons to do that with a 16-13 victory in Super Bowl V over the Dallas Cowboys. Your teammate, linebacker Mike Curtis, has made it clear that he refuses to wear that championship ring, mainly because the game featured so many turnovers. How do you view that victory?
Same way. I mean, Mike and I roomed together up until our last year with the Colts. I mean, we won the game because we played great defense, but our offense, I'm embarrassed to say, was still ineffective, and I'll never understand that. But I'm happy we won, and if I could get the thing on my finger, I would wear it. But my fingers are arthritic, and I can't get any of those Super Bowl rings on. But it was great to get back and win the thing.
9 seconds to go. The game tied. If O'Brien makes it, unless a miracle happens, the Colts are the world champ. It is going to be a 32-yard field goal attempt. Great position right in the middle of the field. Young Jim O'Brien, a rookie. And the kick is up. The kick is good. Jim O'Brien with 5 seconds. The Colts lead 16-13.
As we mentioned at the top, you played for three legendary head coaches in Lombardi, Don Shula for 3 seasons in Baltimore, and of course Bobby Dodd. Was there a certain quality in their coaching style that they all shared?
Yeah, there was. They were men of absolute integrity, all three of them. I'm not saying they were saints. They certainly were not. They were human. But if you said something to the team, and it came from the head coach, everybody knew it was true. Everybody knew there was no attempt to simply mess with our minds. There were times we were frustrated with all three of them because they were so demanding. But the fact that they were so absolutely honest and that they cared about us, we all understood that. And even though I didn't get it about Lombardi until after I was gone from him, it was true of him as well. The other two, it was very clear, and Shula really saved my career. I owe him everything for my NFL career after I left the Packers.
Near the end of your playing career, you spent time as the president of the NFL Players Association. If you were in that same position today, the president of the NFLPA, what would be the top priorities you'd like to see accomplished in terms of player rights?
Player safety, attention, with absolute transparency with regard to brain trauma and an intense study of what the new rules are doing. I'm speaking now of the head-to-head contact where there are ejections and penalties called. I think all of that is saving lives. The new protocol, relatively new protocol, for concussions such that you stay out of action until you return to your baseline in terms of your vital statistics and what your vitals are, whereas guys would have been put back in the very next series in the past, some are out for weeks and weeks, some of them are retired now because their brains do not return to their normal function, and I know that that's saving lives, and I would spend most of my time on that.
How has your health been? I know you mentioned your arthritic hands, but how has your health been since you retired with regards to the head area? Has it all been great, or what has it been like?
Well, I did have multiple concussions, and I had some severe ones because that's documented. And I'm the luckiest guy in the world because my wife says I'm not any dumber than I was before. When we were in high school, we went to school together all the way through. So I don't think that I've lost much function. I do have problems remembering names, and I don't mean in the normal sense. I mean names of people that I ought to know that I've known for 20 years. I don't know why that's a specific area of, I just warn everybody, hey, I stand in my Sunday school class and say, look, I've known you 20 years, but I may see you on the street and I may not know your name, so just tell me. So most people walk up and say, hi, I'm Joe. And other than that, I feel like I've been really blessed. I had a bunch of surgeries to my shoulders and had them replaced and knees and to my deviated septums and that sort of thing, like all of us do, but all my injuries have been structural. I've been really blessed. So health is good, and I'm grateful.
Shortly after your playing career ended, you joined the coaching staff of First Georgia Tech and then the Green Bay Packers before ultimately becoming the head coach at your alma mater in 1980. It was a struggle over the first two seasons before generating a turnaround and winning 9 games in 1985. What was the biggest challenge you encountered as you dealt with your first head coaching job?
The biggest challenge for me was my own inexperience. I thought I knew a lot of football. This is one of the flaws with somebody who plays a long time in the NFL. You think you've learned football, when really all I had learned was how to survive as an offensive center. That's the only thing I was good at. I didn't learn about recruiting. I didn't learn about staff organization. I didn't learn about fundraising. I didn't learn about facilities improvement. I mean, all the various things that are crucial to a college head coach were utterly foreign to me. So my learning curve was the biggest challenge that we faced at Georgia Tech. And then the second thing, following quickly on that, is that meaning all Georgia Tech alums and Letterman, had allowed our facilities and our morale to decline so much that it was we were fighting our way out of a hole. But thanks to Dr. Homer Rice, our athletic director, and some really loyal people that stuck with us through those dark days, we were able to pull it back together, and it became one of the most successful programs in the country over the next 20 years. And that was largely the planning of Dr. Rice, the AD, and Dr. Pettit, the president at that time.
From Georgia Tech, you went on to coach Alabama beginning in 1987. Now, the pressure felt by any head coach at Alabama is incredible, and I can imagine especially so with it being so soon after Bear Bryant's departure 5 years ago and not having any real association with the program. What kind of a burden did you feel being an outsider of sorts?
Well, for people who are crazy enough to want to be a college head coach, you don't feel the pressure of a job. You bring the pressure. The pressure comes from within. So it was no different for me in trying to make the Green Bay Packers or coach the Green Bay Packer offensive line for Bart Starr or coach Georgia Tech or coach Alabama or anywhere else. All that was felt the same to me because the pressure is internal. I wanted so desperately to be successful in every situation that I didn't feel the pressure. But in Alabama, my family certainly did. And that weighed on me, the fact that my wife, Carolyn, and our two children, who were high school and college age, respectively, at that time, they had to hear the remarks and pay attention to what was going on around us, such that it was difficult for them, and that was hard. So, but for me, I loved coaching those guys, and as my son said, Dad, you got to go in a foxhole every day and go to war, and that's fun for an officer, and he's right. It was great fun to coach those guys.
Stacy, still going. Touchdown! And it's a big happy birthday to head coach Bill Curry, 47 years old today. And up on that scoreboard, there's a big 47 points. So how about that?
Your Crimson Tide teams would go 26-10 over three seasons, with a bowl appearance in each season and winning a share of the SEC championship in 1989. Not only did you win SEC Coach of the Year in 89, but you also won the Bobby Dodd Coach of the Year Award, and that honor certainly had to hold a special significance to you, considering who it was named in honor of.
I was so stunned when that happened, I couldn't talk for 2 hours. I just sat there. It really was so wonderful that the committee would, because that Dodd committee, I'm now on it, is deadly serious about getting this award to the right kind of person. And we're not 100%. We've made a couple of mistakes, but not many. And for those people, and the respect I had for the people that were doing the selection of that was one of the great moments in my career. And the fact that it was named after Coach Dodd made it doubly significant.
Soon after that season, that 89 season, which included an appearance in the Sugar Bowl, you resigned from Alabama and took a head coaching position at the University of Kentucky. From what I read, one reason for leaving was the lack of support you were given, despite a strong record. Looking back now, do you have any regret in leaving Alabama, considering the good state in which you had that program and the fact that that would be a team that would win the national championship three seasons later?
Well, I called a team meeting and told them that they would win the national championship. I mean, we all knew we were going to win the national championship, not because of me, but because we had such great leadership and character in that room. And I said, I know you'll win the national championship, and so I'm confident of that, and I'm not worried about it. I'm worried about the few of you that you better graduate, and I want you to understand, if you don't graduate, I will find you. I will come to your house. I'll track you down. And virtually all of them did graduate, and they did win a national championship, but it didn't have much to do with me. I needed to change the situation for my family. They didn't ask me to do it. They didn't complain, but I just knew it was not a healthy deal.
Of course, the man now on the sidelines for the Tide is Nick Saban. With his last national title, he now has five, one with LSU and four in Tuscaloosa, and that four puts him one shy of matching Bear Bryant. It's near impossible to equal his reverence in that region, but did you ever think another coach would come close to matching the number of championships Bear Bryant won there?
Well, I never thought about that in that context, but if I had thought about it, I wouldn't be surprised that somebody like Nick could do that, because you have such an incredible competitive advantage at Alabama. 365 days a year, every Alabama player and coach is motivated and hears from his mom, his grandmother, the guy at the filling station, the guy at the shopping center, you better win the national championship this year. Y'all ain't won one in 2 years. I mean, every day, everybody's motivated. You don't ever have to motivate an Alabama player to play football hard. So you take a great football coach like Saban and put him in that laboratory and that mix, and he's the catalyst. It's almost impossible to compete with him. And it's not going to change as long as he's there or someone of his ilk. somebody that can unite the Alabama family makes that situation well nigh impossible to compete with.
Your last head coaching gig was back in your hometown as you were the first head coach for the new program at Georgia State and would hold that job from 2010 until your retirement. If you could, speak to the task of starting a program basically from scratch, building it from the foundation up.
There's so many things involved that it's hard to know where to start. So the simplest thing is to simply start at the beginning. We didn't have an office. We didn't have a telephone. We didn't have a chin strap or a football or a practice field or a locker room or a jersey. So you got to start with beginning a recruiting effort to find people who are willing to jump on board an embryonic program. Thank you. I was struggling for that word. An embryonic program that are willing to go through the things that we all know we're going to go through. And then it moves toward incorporating a relationship with the faculty and the student body and then the alumni base at the university. And at Georgia State, we had some tremendous advantages because we had great faculty support. The student body was the reason for the program. The student body had voted themselves a hefty increase in the athletic fee, and that's tough to get in these hard economic times, just to have a football program. So there were a lot of advantages there, and you learn to play to your advantages and gradually build up your weaknesses. And they were so obvious there because they were structural and facilities and personnel. And we just tried to go about improving 2% every day if we possibly could. Some days we were successful and some we weren't so successful. But the program's going to work, and it's finally beginning to perform on the field the way we all knew it could.
Despite the enormous uphill battle that Bill Curry described, Georgia State went 6-5 in its inaugural season. After some growing pains prior to as well as following Curry's retirement, the program made its first bowl game last year. We hope you enjoyed this first edition of this expanded Profiles in Sports podcast with more exciting interviews to come. I'm Brian Wright. Thanks so much for listening.